Hitler's War by David Irving. Part 1. Approach to Absolute Power. The chapter is Dictator by Consent. When Hitler became Chancellor on January 30th, 1933, Germany was an international bankrupt in an insolvent world. There were millions of unemployed. On March 5, 1933, his party increased its strength in the elections to 288 of the Reichstag's 647 seats. The Communist Party was banned, a step which Hitler had advised against in his first cabinet of January 30th, fearing a general strike. Quote, "You can't ban 6 million men," unquote, and he began to enact the laws he had promised, including decrees designed to force the Jews out of Germany's professions, Germany's trades, and eventually Germany. He had a sounder appreciation of economics than people believed. Count Lutz Ferenc von Krosigk, whom he had inherited as finance minister, wrote privately after the war, quote, "He dismissed warnings of inflation with the not altogether accurate comment that under a strong government inflation was impossible, in which connection he had an absolute healthy instinct on the necessity of keeping expenditure in line with income," unquote. Hitler restored national confidence in the future, which was the basis for any economic recovery. There were strict price and wage controls. Meanwhile, Dr. Helmar Schacht, the autocratic chairman of the Reichsbank, moved to restore Germany's solvency by introducing strictly bilateral trade agreements and raising credit for Hitler's ambitious programs. Hitler's first power base in 1933 was the labor force. Among the papers of Walter Huell, the 19-year-old student who had shared his Landsberg imprisonment, is this doctrine written in Hitler's spiky hand. Quote, "They must learn to respect each other and be respected again. The intellectual must respect the manual labor and vice versa. Neither can exist without the other. From them, both will emerge the new man, the man of the coming German Reich." Adolf Hitler, Landsberg, 18th of December, 1924. Fortress arrest. End quote. After 1933, the workers were no longer social outcasts. All the cancerous symptoms of industrial unrest, strikes, lockouts, absenteeism, became phantoms of the past. As Hitler's brief successor, Karl Dönitz, was to put it in 1945, quote, "What did the workers care about the Jewish problem and all that? At last they had food and work again, and they were respected human beings," end quote. In April 1933, Hitler closed down the trade unions. He transferred their staff, members, and assets 1 year later to a monolithic German labor front, the DAF. It was the biggest trade union in the world, and one of the most successful. Dr. Robert Ley, the stuttering, fixed-set party official who controlled the DAF for the next 12 years, certainly deserves a better appraisal from history. The DAF regularly received 95% of the subscriptions due, an unparalleled expression of the 30 million members' confidence. With this vast wealth, the DAF built for them holiday cruise liners, housing, shops, hotels, and convalescent homes. It financed the Volkswagen factory, the Vulcan shipyards and production centers in the food industry, and the Bank of German Labor. Hitler respected Ley's ability and was willingly photographed in the company of Ley's beautiful ash-blonde first wife. Labor leader Ley was to stand by Hitler beyond the end. During the months in Landsberg prison, Hitler had mentioned one particular ambition, the construction of a network of superhighways. Schwerin von Krosigk would write, quote, "Hitler used to describe how the city folk returned from their Sunday outings in overflowing trains, getting their buttons torn off, their hats crushed, their good mood ruined, and every benefit of relaxation wasted. How different would it be if the city workers could afford their own cars to go on real Sunday outings without all that? Road building has always been the sign of powerful governments," he said, from the Romans and the Incas down to Napoleon. End quote. Only 12 days after the seizure of power in 1933, Hitler announced the Autobahn construction program. On June 28th, the cabinet passed the law, and a few days later he sent for Dr. Fritz Tott, an engineer who had written a 48-page study of the problems of road building in 1932, and asked him if he would like the job of Inspector General of German Road Construction. He said he had always preferred travel by road to rail, as the contact with people was closer. Quote, "I must have driven 500,000 miles in my 14 years of struggle for power," end quote. Tot accepted the job. The interview lasted barely 3 minutes. On July 5th, Hitler again sent for Tot, strolled for 90 minutes with him, told him what routes the first network would take, laid down the minimum width of traffic lanes, and sent Tot to begin work at once. All this emerges from Tot's own private papers. The military importance of the Autobahns has been exaggerated. The German railroad system was of far greater significance. For the present, the Autobahns were the means whereby Germany's national unity could be enhanced, because Hitler realized that the fight against provincialism and separatist trends would last for many years yet. Simultaneously, Hitler appointed a minister of propaganda and public enlightenment, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, an eloquent 35-year-old Rhinelander, to his cabinet on March 11, 1933. Hitler explained, quote, "One of the chief jobs of the ministry will be to prepare the nation for important government moves. The government's measures would not begin until there had been a certain period of public enlightenment," end quote. Hitler saw the random bickering of the newspapers of the democracies as an inexcusable frittering away of a vital national resource. He believed that the press could become a powerful instrument of national policy. The freedom of editors had already been seriously curtailed by emergency laws passed by the pre-Hitler governments of Heinrich Brüning and Franz von Papen. Goebbels surpassed them both, however, in tackling the dissident voices, cleansing the publishing houses by bringing them into line or simply confiscating them. To establish a virtual Nazi Party press monopoly, Hitler used the Franz Eher Publishing House, which the party had purchased in 1920. At that time, it had been publishing an insolvent Munich daily, the Völkischer Beobachter, with barely 7,000 subscribers. Hitler had appointed Max Amann, his sergeant major in the World War, to manage Eher's in April 1922, and the paper's ratings began to climb. Within a year of the seizure of power in 1933, the Nazi Party would control 86 newspapers with 3,200,000 readers. Laws were enacted closing down 120 socialist and communist printing plants, and these were sold off to the party at knockdown prices. Max Amann soon controlled an empire of 700 newspapers. Jews and Marxists were forbidden, in any case, to practice journalism. From mid-1935, the Catholic-owned press was also purged of divisive trends. As Goebbels emphasized, quote, "I reject the standpoint that there is in Germany a Catholic and a Protestant press, or a workers' press, or a farmers' press, or a city press, or a proletariat press. There exists only a German press," end quote. At the same time, Hitler established his police state. Control of the Reich's police authorities passed progressively into the hands of Heinrich Himmler, Reichsführer of the SS. Himmler had initially controlled the police force in Munich after Hitler came to power. By 1935, he would control all Reich police forces. Hitler readily accepted that Himmler's quote-unquote concentration camps were indispensable for the political re-education of the dissident, and indeed the dissolute as well, because by 1935 the camps would contain more than one hapless inmate whom Hitler had incarcerated as a drastic cure for some unsavory human failing. Quote, "The punishment was not ordered by the Führer to hurt you," Himmler wrote to one alcoholic confined in Dachau on May 18, 1937, "but to retrieve you from a path that has clearly led you and your family to ruin." End quote. Chief of the security police was one Reinhard Heydrich. In March 1933, Himmler had appointed him, then 29, to head the political section at Munich Police HQ. A tall, blonde officer with aquiline features, Heydrich, renowned in later years for his cold-bloodedness, must have had some humor in his dusky soul, because in 1939 he dared to write to the Reichsführer SS that a witch had been identified amongst Hitler's ancestors and duly burned at the stake in 1629. On the nature of Hitler's contacts with Himmler, there is little that can be said with certainty. In pedantic, spiky handwriting, Himmler listed the topics he intended to discuss with the Führer, and he sometimes added Hitler's decisions on each case. The gaps that these notes reveal are so astounding that we must assume that Himmler kept Hitler in the dark about whole areas of his nefarious activities. One of the most important surveillance weapons in Hitler's police state was controlled by Hermann Göring, not Himmler. This was the Forschungsamt, or quote-unquote research office, set up in April 1933 with a monopoly of wiretapping operations. The FA was a high-grade source of police economic and political intelligence. Printed on the characteristic brown paper that gave them their famous name, the quote-unquote brown pages, the wiretaps were distributed to Hitler's ministers on locked dispatch boxes or by pneumatic post on the strictest quote-unquote need-to-know basis. Unhappily, the entire FA archives were destroyed in 1945. The scattered items that have survived demonstrate its sinister efficiency, putting routine wiretaps on the fringe actors of the coming chapters, like Gallater Julius Streicher, Miss Unity Mitford, Princess Stephanie Hohenlohe, Goebbels' mistresses, and even Hitler's adjutant Fritz Wiedemann. The first reference to its work was at a cabinet meeting of March 29, 1933, when Hitler was told of exaggerated reports being filed on anti-Jewish atrocities in Germany. Quote, "The atrocity reports were principally cabled to America by the Hearst Press representative here, Deuss. This has been established beyond doubt by tapping his telephone conversations." End quote. Hitler agreed that Deuss should be deported. German opposition elements were also wiretapped. One brown page related a phone call by the wife of General Kurt von Schleicher to a woman friend with a riddle. Quote, "What is it? Without an I, nobody wants to be it. With an I, everybody." End quote. The answer was Erich, Aryan. Arsch is not a word of great endearment. Hitler prudently cultivated Germany's venerable president, Field Marshal von Hindenburg. Hindenburg was supreme commander, and he could also block any of Hitler's proposals. Hitler wooed him by appointing Dr. Hans Lammers, an expert on constitutional law, as head of the Reich Chancellery. Hitler also undertook to retain Dr. Otto Meissner as chief of the president's chancellery and Franz Selte as minister of labor, promises that he honored until his death 12 years later. Hitler also worked hard to win over the Reichswehr, the armed forces. Germany was permitted only a 100,000-man army, numerically smaller than most comparable countries' fire brigades. Italy, by comparison, had 600,000 soldiers. The Versailles Treaty forbade Germany to manufacture heavy artillery, military aircraft, tanks, or anti-aircraft guns. Her navy was quiescent. She had no air force. Even prior to 1933, Hitler had approached the Reichswehr with all the blandishments and posturing of a statesman courting a neighboring power that he needed as an ally. These early contacts with the Reichswehr had, however, disappointed him. He had revered the retired General Hans von Seeckt until in November 1932, he met him privately in Goering's Berlin apartment. Here Seeckt described his own close relations with the German People's Party. Hitler abruptly stood up and interrupted. Quote, "Herr General Oberst, I thought I was speaking with one of our great army commanders from the World War. That you were flirting with a political party has astonished me. That will be all." End quote. Relations with the current commander-in-chief of the army, the foppish General Kurt von Hammerstein-Eckard, were equally cool. He once drawled to Hitler, quote, "Herr Hitler, if you come to power legally, all well and good. If you do not, I shall open fire." End quote. However, the new war minister whom Hindenburg had appointed, General Werner von Blomberg, had commanded the enclave of East Prussia, and he had come to respect the Nazi Party organization there as a welcome supplement to that exposed province's defenses against the constant threat of Polish attack. He declared his unconditional loyalty to Hitler. His chief of staff, Reichenau, had also come from East Prussia and was by no means deaf to the Nazi ideology. With all the generals, Hitler had one powerful argument. He was going to restore to Germany her striking power, regardless of the restrictions of Versailles. Very shortly after, quote-unquote, seizing power, he had asked to meet the generals and had borrowed Hammerstein's official apartment at No. 14 Bendlerstrasse for the reception. It was February 3, 1933. Arriving with Lammers and Wilhelm Bruckner, his own towering adjutant in SA uniform, Hitler was nervous and it showed throughout the dinner party. He then tapped his glass for silence and delivered a speech of which Hammerstein's adjutant Major Horst von Mellenthin took a detailed note. This reads in part, quote, "There are two possible ways of overcoming our desperate situation. Firstly, seizing by force new markets for our production. Secondly, obtaining new Lebensraum for our population surplus. And there's an asterisk related to that in the middle of this note here. Asterisk reads, another general present, Kurt Liebman, noted his words thus, quote, we might fight for new export markets, or we might, and this would be better, conquer new Lebensraum in the East and Germanize it ruthlessly, end quote. All right, and back up. Lebensraum for our population surplus, asterisk, and then a peace-loving public will not stomach objectives like these. It will have to be prepared for them. Germany must recapture complete freedom of decision. This will not be feasible unless we first win political power. This is why my aim is to restore our political strength first. My Nazi Party organization is necessary to get our citizens back into shape. Democracy is a utopia. It is impossible. You won't find it in either industry or the armed forces. So it's not likely to be of much use in such a complicated situation as a state. Democracy is the worst of all possible evils. Only one man can and should give the orders. This is the ideal I've been working towards since 1918, and when I think that my movement, which has swollen from 7 men to 12 millions, has raised me aloft from a simple soldier to Reich Chancellor, it seems to show that there's still a large part of the public waiting to be won over to this ideal. The public has got to learn to think as a nation. This will weld it together. This cannot be done by persuasion alone, but only by force. Those who won't agree must get their arms twisted. Our supreme commandment is to maintain our unity. This process is today well underway. This is why I built up my organization and dedicated it to the state. Our target is the restoration of German might. That's what I'm fighting for with every means. To restore our might, we'll need the Wehrmacht, the armed forces. What matters above all is our defense policy, as one thing's certain, that our last battles will have to be fought by force. The Nazi Party organization was not created by me to bear arms, but for the moral education of the individual. This I achieve by combating Marxism. My organization will solely confine itself to the ideological education of the masses in order to satisfy the army's domestic and foreign policy needs. I am committed to the introduction of conscription forbidden by the Versailles Treaty. This path I have set out to you will take many years to tread. If France has real statesmen, she will set about us during the preparatory period, not herself, but probably using her vassals in the East. So it will be wrong to commit ourselves to too much to the idea of equal armaments. We must make all our economic and military preparations in secret and only come out into the open when they are 100% complete. Then we will have regained the freedom of decision. Then we must decide, foreign markets or colonies? I am for colonies. One day the time will come when we can raise a mighty army, and let me emphasize that I will never use the armed forces to fight an internal enemy. I have other means of doing that. There's another asterisk here. The SS. At his cabinet meeting on January 30th, 1933, Hitler ruled that even if the communists called a general strike, he would not permit the armed forces to put it down. So I ask you to understand my aims and accept my political aid. With my movement, a miracle has happened for the fatherland. This miracle will not recur, however, so we must use it. End quote. He could hardly have made himself clearer. Even so, his audience was unimpressed. Someone muttered, quote, is that the man supposed to be the Führer of the German people? End quote. By then, however, Hitler's revolution was only 4 days old, and they all had much to learn. 4 days later, the cabinet discussed various ways of reducing unemployment. Hitler stated, quote, every publicly supported project for creating employment must be judged by one criterion alone. Is it, or is it not, requisite for the restoration of the German nation's fighting capability? End quote. He laid down that for the next 5 years until 1938, there would be only one guiding aim, quote, everything for the Wehrmacht, end quote. A few days later, Hitler forced through Goering's big, quote-unquote, civil aviation budget. The cabinet record related, quote, the Reich Chancellor Hitler explained that it is a matter of providing the German nation in camouflaged form with a new air force, which is at present forbidden under the terms of the Versailles Treaty, unquote. Hitler told Blomberg that the embryo Panzer and Luftwaffe troops would be favored as an elite for the next few years. He particularly wanted the Luftwaffe officer corps to be imbued with a quote-unquote turbulent spirit of attack. The initial quote-unquote risk Luftwaffe was to be ready by late 1935. Of deeper interest are the instructions that Hitler issued to the German Navy. The Commander-in-Chief, Admiral Erich Raeder, was called to a separate briefing by Hitler on his coming to power. The Navy had already discussed with Blomberg's predecessor in November 1932 an extensive naval instruction program. Hitler now instructed Raeder to base his calculations exclusively on the French and Russian navies. Raeder's adjutant, Captain Erich Schulte-Monting, recalls, quote, Hitler told Raeder it would be the tentpole of his future foreign policy to coexist peacefully with Britain, and he proposed to give practical expression to this by trying to sign a naval agreement with her. He would like to keep the German Navy relatively small, as he wanted to recognize Britain's right to naval supremacy on account of her status as a world power. He proposed to recommend the balance of forces accordingly. End quote. Before their eyes, the Germans now saw Hitler's promises coming true. On September 23, 1933, he ceremonially dug the first spadeful of Fritz Todt's Autobahn network at Frankfurt, a city where 8,000 men were unemployed in 1932. At 7 a.m., the first 700 men marched out across the River Main to the sound of bands playing. At 10 a.m., Hitler spoke to them, quote, I know that this festive day will soon be over, that times will come when rain or frost or snow embitters you and makes the work much harder. Nobody will help us, however, if we don't help ourselves. End quote. After he had gone, the workers stormed the little heap of earth that he had shoveled to take home souvenirs. Such was the almost religious fervor that Hitler generated. Todt wrote to a professor on September 30th, 1933, quote, I'm absolutely convinced that any man coming together with the Führer for just 10 minutes a week is capable of 10 times his normal output. End quote. Gradually, the network of highways spread. They followed routes that engineers had previously claimed impassable, for example, across broad moors like the south shore of Lake Chiemsee in Bavaria. Long viaducts like the Mengfall Bridge, 200 feet high, were personally selected by Hitler from 70 competing designs for their simple but solid lines. Quote, What we're building, he explained, will still be standing long after we've passed on. Unquote. He toured the sites and spoke with the workers. Quote, When I'm as old as you, he flattered one 70-year-old laborer at Darmstadt, I'd like to be able to work like you now. End quote. In November 1936, he gave orders that the Reich's western frontiers were to be marked on the autobahns by monuments 130 feet high. With his rearmament program already underway, the next logical step would be to disrupt the League of Nations. Hitler had earlier told Hindenburg that it resembled nothing if not a ganging up by the victors to ensure that they could exact the spoils and booty of the World War from the vanquished. For a long time, he had, however, believed in continuing the discussions in Geneva, while his generals favored pulling out. Late in September, Neurath also urged him to pull out of Geneva, but again, Hitler had adopted the more moderate view. It was not until the morning of October 4th that Blomberg succeeded in talking him around. Hitler formally notified the cabinet of the decision on the 13th. He now proposed to withdraw from the League the next day, October 14th, 1933. It was a risky decision, but when Hitler sent Walter Funk, Goebbels' state secretary, to East Prussia to procure the field marshal's approval, Hindenburg boomed. Quote, At last, a man with the courage of his convictions. Unquote. At the cabinet meeting on October 13th, Hitler announced that he would dissolve the Reichstag next day, too, to give the public a chance to vote their approval of his quote-unquote peace policies in a plebiscite. On November 12th, 40.5 million Germans voted in his favor, or over 95% of all votes cast. 2 days later, the Deputy Chancellor Papen congratulated Hitler before the assembled cabinet. Quote, We, your nearest and dearest colleagues, stand here today under the impact of the most extraordinary and overwhelming votes of support ever accorded by a nation to its leader. Through the genius of your leadership and through the ideals you recreated before us, you have succeeded in just 9 months in creating from a nation torn by internal strife and bereft of hope, one united Reich with hope and faith in the future. End quote. Bypassing his own foreign ministry, Hitler began to send Joachim von Ribbentrop, the haughty but well-connected businessman whom Rudolf Hess had appointed as head of the Nazi Party's own foreign bureau, on diplomatic missions. Significantly, the first in November 1933 was to Britain. In London, Ribbentrop wooed Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald and met leading politicians like Stanley Baldwin, Sir John Simon, and Anthony Eden. Ribbentrop's own secret notes for Hitler, reporting these meetings, have now been found. He had assuaged MacDonald's fears about the Jewish problem. Quote, "I told him," Ribbentrop minuted, "that in our experience, such a revolution in most other countries would have probably cost the lives of several tens of thousands of Jews, but that Hitler was anything but bloodthirsty, and that we in Germany had solved this problem by a 24-hour boycott and by taking certain clear measures against being swamped by Jews." End quote. Ribbentrop waved aside an interruption by the Prime Minister, saying, quote, "Probably a more humane manner of solving such a problem has never been hit upon. We regard it as astonishing that the healthy British people have allowed Jewish emigres to turn their heads." End quote. Germany was confident that the whole world would eventually sympathize. On November 20th, 1933, Ribbentrop saw the conservative leader, Stanley Baldwin, quote, "I told him," he reported, "that a new war between Germany and France was quite impossible, as was one between Britain and Germany, and that this is a fundamental principle in the mind of the Chancellor, not only during his lifetime, but as a testament for his nation for future years." End quote. Ribbentrop truthfully reassured the British that Hitler had no intention of developing a global maritime strategy, so Britain and Germany could easily resolve any differences over the size of their respective navies. Later that day, the Prime Minister described himself, as Ribbentrop reported to Hitler, as a great believer in friendship with Nazi Germany. 6 days later, MacDonald repeated that his government would do what it could to reach an accord with Hitler. Quote, "When you report to the Chancellor," the Prime Minister said, "please tell him in confidence from me that we shall certainly find a common path to tread." End quote. Ribbentrop claimed that it was thanks to his secret diplomacy with Baldwin, Simon, and Anthony Eden that the latter paid his first visit to Berlin in February 1934. British Ambassador Sir Eric Phipps did what he could to freeze Ribbentrop out of the talks. Characteristically for Ribbentrop was already trampling his way into the upper echelons of power, he dictated this immediate plan to Hitler. Quote, "I hear that the Chancellor, Hitler, is to breakfast with Mr. Eden and the British Ambassador. I should like to suggest that he remark to Mr. Eden that I have the Chancellor's confidence in foreign affairs, as this is my sole legitimation." End quote. Writing to Hitler again on February 19th to urge him to allow Eden to return home with some kind of success, the Englishman was young and Francophile, but he had fought well in the war and was certainly an up-and-coming conservative politician. Ribbentrop repeated, quote, "I should also like to remind you how necessary and worthwhile it would be for the Chancellor to mention in his talk with Mr. Eden that it is I who have his confidence in foreign affairs." End quote. The obstacle to agreement with Britain remained her ties to France. A few weeks later, as Ribbentrop's secret files show, he attempted to secure a deal with the French. Visiting the 70-year-old foreign minister, Louise Barthou, in Paris on March 4, 1934, he learned of the quote-unquote dark forces at the Quai d'Orsay, like Barthou's deputy Alex Lager, who had always been militantly anti-German. Barthou challenged Ribbentrop to explain how Hitler could talk of peace when every French agent, he pointed here to a thick dossier, was reporting that he was madly rearming for war. Barthou also referred specifically to the paramilitary training of the SA and SS. Ribbentrop rejoined that France was also rearming in violation of the Treaty of Versailles. It seemed that France would remain a problem. On August 25, 1934, Ribbentrop reported to Hitler that they would somehow have to eliminate the Francophile tendencies of the British Foreign Office. Perhaps they should get to work on King George V. Quote, "In England," he dictated, "the crown has a vastly greater influence than we have been accustomed to assume. As the royal family has certain sympathies for Germany, I have the hope that we shall meet there with some assistance for our foreign policy. I shall keep the Chancellor au courant. I shall report separately," Ribbentrop added in his flamboyant handwriting. on the fundamental question of how an accord with Britain is to be achieved. End quote. In 1933, Hitler's powers were still far from absolute. He had no influence over the senior army appointments, for example, and General von Schwedler's army personnel branch was a quote-unquote hotbed of reaction in his eyes. In February 1934, however, the army's commander-in-chief Hammerstein was replaced by Baron Werner von Fritsch. Fritsch used an outsized monocle. He had a grating academic voice and a manner of sitting bolt upright with his hands on his knees, as though this were so prescribed in some army manual. For all this, however, Fritsch was a fervent nationalist. He shared with many Germans a hatred of Jews, the quote-unquote Jewish press, and a belief that the, quote, the pacifists, Jews, Democrats, black, red, and gold, and the French are all one and the same, namely people bent on Germany's perdition, end quote. He had a soft spot for Hitler and ordained in February 1934 that the army should include the Nazi swastika in its insignia. From his private letters and manuscripts, it is clear that Fritsch came to like working for Hitler, but could find as little respect for the quote-unquote hothead surrounding him as could they for this conservative, hesitant, and cautious general. On the day Fritsch first reported to him, Hitler told him, quote, create an army that will be as powerful as possible, of inner homogeneity and uniformity, and of the highest possible standard of training, end quote. The success of Hitler's January 1933 quote-unquote revolution had rendered Ernst Röhm's street army of brownshirt brawlers and bullies largely superfluous. The SA had swollen to 2.5 million men. Encouraged initially by Blomberg and Reichenau, it had been given rudimentary military training by the regular army as a sop to party feelings. By early 1934, however, the SA wanted more. It became a real threat not only to the puny regular army, but to Hitler too. Röhm believed that Hitler was betraying the quote-unquote socialist character of his program, and he demanded the creation of a people's army based on the SA. Hitler had seen this storm brewing since the summer of 1933, when he had addressed a joint meeting of SA and Reichswehr officers at Bad Godesberg on the Rhine. There, he had explained that every revolution must be followed by a period of evolution. This play on words left the SA unsatisfied. Friction increased, despite an appeal by Blomberg to Röhm in mid-January 1934 not to rock the boat. On February 1st, the day Fritsch took over the army, Röhm responded with a memorandum demanding nothing less than a merger of the regular army into the SA, with himself, Röhm, as commander-in-chief. To Röhm, quote, revolutionary spirit, unquote, was all important, but not to Fritsch. Quote, the army is founded on discipline, he argued at a worried conference with Blomberg on February 3rd, and not on any, quote-unquote, revolutionary spirit, end quote. Together, they resolved to defeat Röhm. For diplomatic reasons, Hitler tried to postpone a showdown. When the British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden visited Berlin to complain about the secret Luftwaffe and the violations of the spirit of Versailles, Hitler pledged that the huge SA would be demilitarized. He summoned the SA leaders and Reichswehr generals to the War Ministry building on February 28th and rudely dispelled Röhm's aspirations to an SA People's Army. One army general, Kurt Liebman, noted that day, quote, Hitler said this, quote, when I took over the government in January 1933, I felt I was marching forward a long, broad, well-paved road. Then, however, that road got narrower, and the surface worse. It turned into a narrow footpath, and today I have a feeling that I am inching my way forward, along a tightrope, while every day fresh burdens are thrust upon me, now on the right, now on the left. End quote. Only the existing Reichswehr, with its professional officers, could satisfy his main need. According to another general, Maximilian von Weichs, who took shorthand notes of the speech, Hitler added, quote, the new army must be capable of all manner of defense within 5 years, and of all manner of attack within 8. End quote. Since the Western powers would probably not permit Germany to win Lebensraum, short, sharp wars might be necessary in the West. Quote, and after them, wars in the East. End quote. Hitler later learned, perhaps from a telephone surveillance that Rom had that same day ridiculed him as, quote, that ignorant World War corporal, end quote. The Forschungsamt put a wiretap on the principal SA telephones. Rom's movements were watched. He was seen in contact with the former War Minister Schleicher, and with foreign diplomats. One diplomat, evidently a Frenchman, encouraged him that he might become the quote-unquote Bonaparte of the Third Reich. The SA was observed to be stockpiling weapons, evidently for a quote-unquote second revolution in which Hitler would be deposed. Although Ernst Röhm was one of his former closest friends, one of the privileged few with whom he exchanged the familiar "Du," Hitler decided to make an example of him. His motives are still obscure. Only once in September 1939 is Hitler known to have discussed privately what he knew of Röhm's machinations, and by that time he was already probably rationalizing rather than recalling. Quote, I knew that in France particularly there were powerful forces in urging intervention. The terms of the Versailles Dictate provided justification enough. I have to thank the French ambassador, François Poncet, alone, that it did not come to that. I was reading all his dispatches, intercepted by the FA. I knew that Röhm was mixed up in treasonable dealings with him and the French. I could see, however, that Poncet was confidentially advising Paris against any intervention. The French should wait until civil war broke out here, which would make things easier for them. And there's an asterisk relating to that. The Forschungsamt was continuously deciphering the French diplomatic cables, but the French diplomatic archives do not now appear to contain any reports indicating that Röhm was conspiring with M. François Poncet, and in correspondence with me, the latter has denied it. Back up. It was only knowing this that kept me going throughout 1933 and 1934. End quote. Certain facts are clear. The SA was planning to overthrow Hitler's government. Shadow ministers had already been nominated. Blomberg showed to Hitler an apparently genuine order signed by Röhm on May 23rd for the SA to procure arms where it could, so as to, quote, put muscle into the SA's dealings with the Wehrmacht, end quote. The language could hardly have been plainer. Hitler was convinced. He told his cabinet later, quote, this completed the evidence of high treason, end quote. Soon his agents indicated that the SA group Berlin-Brandenburg under Karl Ernst was stockpiling illegal arms for an operation at the end of June. This gave him something of a deadline, but Hitler allowed the plot to thicken first. At the beginning of June, he had a four-hour showdown with Röhm. Röhm gave his word of honor to go on leave to Bavaria from June 7th, and to send the SA on 30 days leave in July. One high-ranking army officer, Colonel Edward Wagner, wrote to his wife on the 11th, quote, rumor has it that Röhm won't be coming back, end quote. Someone selected the last day of June 1934, a Saturday, for the purge. Saturday was certainly Hitler's favorite day for staging coup de theater in later years. He evidently tipped off Admiral Raeder that the balloon would go up, as the admiral in turn cryptically recommended his senior staff to postpone a week-long study cruise that they were planning for that week, without giving any cogent reason. Both Raeder and Goering were guests at a dinner with the British ambassador on June 16th, during Hitler's absence in Venice. Goering, a woman journalist noted in her diary, arrived 20 minutes late, medals aclank. Quote, I beg your pardon, he apologized. Message from Venice that Führer had booked a call and I had to wait for him to come to the phone. End quote. Leaning across the table to Raeder, he added, quote, I was willing to fly straight down to him if he needed, but he said, quote, stay where you are. I'm coming back sooner than I thought, unquote. Something's up, end quote. The admiral noted the journalist, bit his lip. François Poncet smirked and the servants carried on without a word. Goering. Rumors multiplied. Franz von Papen made hostile references to the Nazi speech in Marburg. On June 21st, Hindenburg told Hitler to, quote, bring the troublemakers finally to reason, end quote. Hitler told Goebbels that day that he had seen through Papen. Quote, he's caused himself a whole heap of trouble, he said, end quote. The next day, June 22nd, He had a plane bringing Victor Lutze, a reliable if colorless brown shirt commander, over from Hanover, and after swearing him to secrecy, told him he had received word that Ernst Röhm was plotting against the quote-unquote reactionary Reichswehr. He intended to retire him, he said, and he told Lutze to stand by to receive further orders. On the 23rd, General von Fritsch began issuing orders alerting his army units. Machine gun nests appeared in the corridors of the War Ministry. The Army discussed with the SS how far it could abet operations against the SA by supplying weapons, ammunition, and transport to the SS. In the files of Army District 7, i.e. Munich, there is a cryptic note dated June 28, 1934. Quote, Reich War Ministry advises, Chancellor's attitude is, I am convinced of Army's... Chancellor's attitude is, I am convinced of Army's loyalty. Reich now, in buoyant mood. Röhm's order. End quote. Hitler and Goering left Berlin that day for the Ruhr to attend the wedding of the local Gauleiter Terboven. Under enemy interrogation in July 1945, Goering would testify, quote, There, in Essen, we were informed that Röhm had given the SA orders to stand by and had summoned all SA commanders to meet him at Wiese. End quote. There were odd signs of something in the air. Lutze noticed that Hitler was called away to the telephone. Initiating steps to crush what looked like a putsch, Hitler sent Goering straight back to Berlin. An uneasy atmosphere descended on the wedding feast. There were phone calls from Goering and Himmler in Berlin, and from the Gestapo. Goering's secretary, Pilly Korner, arrived from Berlin bringing a sheaf of wiretaps. These seemed to indicate that Röhm and his associates were planning to start their putsch at 4 p.m. on Saturday the 30th. Hitler announced, quote, I'm going to make an example of them, end quote. Röhm was with his henchmen at Bad Wiese, a watering hole outside Munich. Late on June 28th, Hitler telephoned to Röhm's adjutant, orders to meet him there at 11 a.m. on the 30th. Erhard Milch's recollection in 1945 was that Goering had sent his state secretary, Paul Korner, over to Hitler with a number of Forschungsamt wiretaps proving Röhm's guilt. Former Forschungsamt employees have confirmed that Regierungsrat Rudolf Popp, chief of the FA quote-unquote assignments section, played a major part in uncovering the coming putsch. The next morning he phoned Goebbels in Berlin and ordered him to fly over immediately and join him at the Rhein Hotel Dresden in Bad Godesberg. Quote, So, it's on, wrote Goebbels in his diary. In God's name, he then wrote, and added, Anything, however, is better than this awful waiting. End quote. Hitler told him to bring his new private secretary, Christa Schroeder, then 25, with him. Wearing a lightweight white summer coat, the minister arrived at the hotel at 4 p.m. Victor Lutze joined them both a few minutes later. Hitler briefed Goebbels that he was about to take out the mutinous SA leadership, among them many of Goebbels' closest friends. Quote, Drawing blood, recorded Goebbels, with approval. Got to realize that mutiny cost them their neck. I agree with this. If do it you must, then ruthlessly. Proofs that Röhm was conspiring with François Poncet, Schlecker, and Strasser. So action, end quote, he added in this previously unpublished diary. Quote, After reaching this decision, the Führer is very calm. We while away the hours in discussions. Nobody must notice a thing. Talk with Lutze, the new SA chief of staff. He's very good, end quote. For an hour, they watched a torchlight parade staged by the labor service, and a human torchlight swastika forming on the far bank of the river as the sun went down. Quote, The Führer is tense but very firm, Goebbels narrated. We all keep silent, end quote. Toward midnight, as both Lutze and Goebbels recorded with curiosity in their diaries, Hitler took another phone call from Berlin. Quote, The rebels are arming themselves, Goebbels recorded. Not a moment to be lost, unquote. A pale and trembling Hitler announced, quote, We're on our way, unquote. He advised Goebbels to phone his wife to betake their family to safety in Berlin. At midnight on the 29th, Hitler startled them all with the decision to fly to Bavaria in person. His adjutant, Bruckner, speculated that a courier had brought the further crucial information from Berlin. Word certainly reached Hitler before he took off that incidents had broken out in Bavaria and that the Berlin SA had been alerted for some kind of operation at 4 p.m. the next day, the 30th. Hitler took off soon after 2 a.m. on the 30th of June for Munich. Army officers were waiting on the airfield to greet him. He tore the insignia from two bemused local SA commanders, August Schneidhuber and Wilhelm Schmidt, and packed them off to the Stadelheim prison, where they were joined later by a busload of other SA worthies. After a brief call on the local Ministry of the Interior, his party set out for Bad Wiessee at 5:30 a.m., riding in three open Mercedes limousines, with Hitler, Lütze, and Hess in the first, detectives in the second, and Goebbels in the third. Not without personal risk, Hitler himself routed Rom, Edmund, Heines, and his other henchmen out of their rooms at the Wiessee Lakefront Hotel. Goebbels described in his diary, quote, "The chief was brilliant, Heines pitiful, with a rent boy, Rom. Heines pitiful, with a rent boy. Rom remained calm. Everything went off very smoothly," unquote. Heines appealed to Lütze as he was taken away, quote, "I've done nothing, help me," end quote. He and the others were, however, beyond redemption. By 8 a.m., he was back in Munich. Of great interest is the record of Hitler's utterances filed that day by the headquarters of General Adam, commanding the local army district. Quote, "All the SA commanders are now under lock and key except Gruppenführer Ernst. I, Hitler, as aware of his, and in brackets, Rom's with a question mark, weaknesses, but I hoped for a long time to be able to channel this affair along the right lines. It's all over now. It's been infinitely hard for me to part from comrades who have fought in this struggle of ours for years on end. These people would have ruined the entire SA. I had to put a stop to it sometime. The scenes during our swoop on Wiessee were scandalous and shameful, more disgusting than I would have ever thought possible. Now I have laid down a clear line. The army is the only bearer of arms. Every man, whether SA or not, is in future at the army's disposal. Any man at whom the Wehrmacht crooks its finger belongs to it. I have maximum faith in the Wehrmacht and the Reich War Minister. A line has had to be drawn. You can rest assured that I shall now establish order." End quote. There were admittedly some facts that did not fit in with Hitler's version of events. Far from Putsching in Berlin, SA Gruppenführer Ernst was halfway to Bremen Harbor, setting out on a cruise with his young bride. At Potsdam, a gang of men burst into General Schleicher's house and gunned him down at his desk. His wife, who got in the gunsman's way, was also shot. Ironically, Göring's Forschungsamt was still tapping Schleicher's phone. When homicide detectives from the Potsdam prosecutor's office telephoned the Justice Ministry from the house to report that Schleicher was evidently the victim of, quote, a political assassination, unquote, Göring angrily contradicted them. The official version, he said, would be quite different. General von Bredow also met a sticky end, as did some of Papen's staff, including his secretary, the controversial Dr. Edgar Jung, and there's an asterisk relating to that. The secret state archives in Munich reveal that Dr. Jung had been a hired assassin employed by the Bavarian government, and that he had liquidated, among others, the separatist leader Heinz Orbis in 1924. And back up. Back at the party headquarters in Munich, Hitler phoned the code word Calibri to Berlin, the signal for Göring to launch the counterattack there. Later that morning, he revealed to his cronies that some of those arrested were to be shot. The Gestapo had a list of names, several marked with a cross. Running his eye down the list, Lütze noticed that Rom was not among them. He was, of course, a close friend of Hitler. For some time, Hess argued that it would not be fair to spare Rom. The axe should fall on all or none of them. Rom's name, however, was still not checked on the list of seven names, which Hitler turned over to Sepp Dietrich, the stocky commander of the SS Liebenstarte Lifeguards Regiment, at 5 p.m. The six others were stood before a firing squad at Stadelheim prison later that day. At 8 p.m., Hitler flew back to Berlin by Junkers 52 plane with Goebbels. Göring met them at Tempelhof Airport. Hitler found that the secret Air Force's deputy chief, Erhard Milch, had drawn up a guard of honor in the uniforms of the new Luftwaffe. Göring now revealed to Hitler's quiet dismay that he had arbitrarily added several other names to the hit list. Quote, Göring reports that all went to plan in Berlin, recorded Goebbels that day. Only cock-up, Miss Schleicher bought it too. Tough, but can't be helped. End quote. Christa Schroeder, Hitler's private secretary, whom he had commanded to accompany him throughout this violent excursion to Bavaria, recalls sitting alone later that evening in the chancellery, eating her vegetarian meal, when Hitler unexpectedly joined her and exclaimed, quote, "So, now I have taken a bath and I feel clean as a newborn babe again," unquote. Much had in fact happened that unsettled Hitler. Goering had wantonly liquidated Gregor Strasser, Hitler's rival, and there had been a rash of killings in Bavaria. Hitler learned that somebody had killed his old friend, Pastor Bernhard Stempfle, an almost daily acquaintance of earlier years, who had helped edit the turgid pages of Mein Kampf for publication. Hitler's adjutant Bruckner later described in private papers how Hitler vented his annoyance on Himmler when the Reichsfuhrer SS appeared at the Chancellery with a final list of the victims. 82 all told. Holy shit. In later months, Victor Lutze told anybody who would listen that the Führer had originally listed only 7 men. He had offered Rom suicide, and when Rom declined this quote-unquote offer, Hitler had him shot too. And there's an asterisk related to that down there. Martin Bormann's diary lists 7 names on June 30th, 1934. Quote, "Rom plot uncovered. Schneidhuber, Count Spreti, Heinz, Hain, Schmidt, Heidebreck, Ernst, all shot," end quote. And back up. Hitler's 7 had become 17 and then 82. Quote, "The Führer was thus put in the embarrassing position of having to sanction all 82 killings afterward," complained Lutze, and end quote. Lutze put the blame squarely on Himmler and Goering. Over lunch on July 1st, Dr. Goebbels found Hitler pale and bitter. Quote, "Goering tenders his report," he wrote. "Execution's almost over. A few still needed. It's tough, but necessary. Ernst, Strasser, Senle, Stempfle, Detten," with a cross. "One final sweep, and we're through the worst. For 20 years, there must be peace," end quote. He whiled away the afternoon hours with Hitler. Quote, "I cannot leave him on his own," reported Goebbels, no doubt pleased to be in this sanctuary. "He's suffering badly, but hanging tough. The death sentences are pronounced with the utmost gravity. Around 60 all told," unquote. Under pressure from others, Hitler that day yielded and ordered Rom's name added to the death list. Quote, "Twice Rom is left alone for 20 minutes with a pistol," unquote, recorded Goebbels in his dramatic diary of these events. Quote, "He doesn't use it and is then shot. With that, it's all over," end quote. Sepp Dietrich called in to report, quote, "A bit white about the gills," as Goebbels described, adding, "We're not cut out to be executioners," end quote. In an act of rare magnanimity, Hitler ordered state pensions provided for the next of kin of all the people murdered in the Night of the Long Knives, as June 30th, 1934 came to be known. Even so, he began to suffer nightmares and could not sleep. His medical records reveal that stomach ailments began to plague him from this episode on. But the long-term benefits seemed worth it. He had purchased the undivided loyalty of the Reichswehr generals, formed a quote-unquote blood brotherhood, one might say. On July 3rd, Blomberg, as war minister, thanked him on behalf of the assembled cabinet. The cabinet retrospectively legalized most of the killings as quote-unquote acts of emergency. There's an asterisk again. Not all the killings were so legalized. The cabinet minutes of August 2nd, 1934 refer to a number of people charged with having settled private scores. In one case, a litigant had shot a man on June 30th simply for having testified against him during a civil action. And back up. Quote, "One can see clearly again," wrote Goebbels. "Events came dramatically to a head. The Reich was on the edge of an abyss. The Führer saved it," end quote. Over the next days, however, it dawned on Hitler that many of his henchmen had taken things into their own hands. After a visit by Hitler to his lakeside cottage, Goebbels recorded cryptically, quote, "He now sees things quite clearly. Lutze has become suspicious, too," end quote. Hitler had belatedly deduced the extent to which Goering, Himmler, and the armed forces had manipulated him. After the cabinet meeting, Hitler flew to East Prussia and reported to the fast-fading president. Hindenburg was sympathetic. Quote, "My dear Chancellor," he whispered, "those who make history must be able to shed blood," end quote. That's the end of the chapter.